This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
I'm Professor Richard Gershon from the University of Mississippi School of Law, host of In Legal Terms. If you're enjoying this podcast, I encourage you to listen to In Legal Terms, the show about you and your rights. We find interesting legal topics to bring to you and let you know how the law affects you. Find In Legal Terms on any podcasting platform on your smart device or on our website, inlegalterms.mpbonline.org.
From MPB Think Radio, this is Money Talks. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lotcher-Janderson, president of New Perspectives, and Ryder Tapp, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. They're both chartered financial analysts, and Ryder holds the Certificate in Investment Performance Measurement from the CFA Institute. Our primary goal on Money Talks is to answer your personal finance questions. Each week between your calls, though, we look for interesting and useful topics to discuss. And today it's investing, because investing in the stock market is a smart way to help you reach short-term or long-term financial goals. But if you're just starting out, how do you know how much to invest and what to invest in? On today's show, we'll talk about investing and give you some suggestions for getting started on the right foot. And as I mentioned, Nancy and Ryder are ready for those personal finance questions. You can contact us by email. Send it to money@mpbonline.org. So good morning, Ryder. Let's start with you with financial news on your mind.
Good morning. So before the show, Nancy and I were talking about just all of the things that have come, and we're going to have millions of these things to talk about from the Secure Act 2.0.
And a new law.
So we've mentioned this before, because there are, you know, some big changes that impacted folks this year, but this is something that it impacts mostly its retirement savings accounts, things around IRA contributions and distributions. And there are parts of the act that aren't even going to be implemented for the next 10 years. 2033, I believe, is one of the RMD changes are. So the first things we have talked about, the age at which you take RMDs has changed.
And tell them what an RMD is.
RMD is a required minimum distribution.
And how is that determined?
People
want to know.
It is a required minimum distribution. The reason you have a required minimum distribution is you've gotten a tax break for putting this money in.
And Uncle Sam wants his money, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
And so tell him what an RMD is.
No,
Nancy,
you go ahead. Oh, gosh. Now he's mad at me.
How is that RMD calculated? Nancy, that's a great question.
It changes every year because you have to get the
What's
value
that based on?
Of your...
The value of what?
Your retirement account on
12/31. That's right. 12/31, what year?
Of the previous year.
The previous year, Kevin. That's the year it changed. And then how do we calculate
then
that?
Then you use that number and you divide it by a number that's based on your age. And you can go to the IRS tables and you look at that, your age, and you find the divisor, and that tells you what you have to take out the next year.
You know, if I didn't know better, I would swear you two were an old married couple.
Really, I know. We do this all the time, all day long.
So that used to be, it started at age 70 and a half, which, as I always like to say, everybody else hated. I loved the age 70 and a half. But it moved up to age 72 with the last, I believe it was with the last Secure Act. And it's
right
now bumped up to age 73. So there were a lot of people last year who turned 72 this year. Last year, they were thinking about, okay, I got to start my RMD planning. I got to know what I'm doing here. All of a sudden, they don't have to do it. So of course, you can take money out of these.
Well, be cautious about the who has to start taking it at 72 versus can delay, because it's the bump up to 73 is for those who turn 72 after the end of last year.
So, correct. Okay. Yes.
So do that math for me. So are we already at 73?
Well, yes. But technically, I think this year there's really nobody who is going to be new to RMDs this year. The only people who are going to be taking their first RMDs out of a traditional IRA, not a beneficiary IRA, because those rules are different, and those have changed again too.
Lots of rules.
Those have actually changed, not even Secure Act related. That's just an IRS interpretation that's changed those. We'll get back to that. But there's nobody who's really new to RMDs unless last year was your first year and you were able and you chose to deliver delay that until this year. If you turned 72 last year and chose to delay your first RMD, which you can do, then you will have to take that RMD this year. And I guess you won't have to, and of course, you'll have to take an RMD this year as well because you'll be 73 anyway. If you are turning 73 this year, then last year you're sitting around thinking you had an RMD. Now you don't. You can still plan around that. Maybe it does make sense to take a little out of that IRA just to reduce those future income taxes, especially if you're in a lower tax bracket this year. It can make sense. You can use that. As long as you're over 70 and a half, you can use your IRA for qualified charitable distributions, which is another provision that we really love. That qualified charitable distribution, anyone over 70 and a half can distribute. The rule was up to $100,000.
Wow, that's a lot of charity.
That's right. Yes. Out of their IRA. And I have seen, again, this is getting into a picky point. I have seen some people question whether or not that's allowed for beneficiary IRAs. I am fairly confident it is. I think I even downloaded the IRS ruling letter on my computer. Always go to the source on those things. But they're going to start indexing that to inflation, which is great because $100,000 today, that's a lot of money.
Yeah,
that's a lot of money. But say
and a lot of income that you can then bypass as far as taxes.
That is very important. It's a lot of income you can bypass for income tax purposes. But in 10 years, if you wanted to make a huge, generous gift, maybe $100,000, it just $100,000 just doesn't buy what it used to, does it?
Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, one other thing that's in this new act for younger people and newer people to retirement savings is a provision that you can take out $1,000 a year for any kind of emergency expenses. And it has to be repaid within 3 years. But then that helps us when we start talking to young people about opening IRAs, starting their company plans, to know that, oh, gosh, I might need that money. Well, there is a way to access it. So that's a real plus.
And also a time when you lose your job might be an emergency.
Yeah,
and that's when
absolutely.
You have to access that old employer plan. They did put a couple of other provisions in there, things like federally declared disasters. If you're a victim of domestic abuse, you can self-certify to withdraw some of those funds. And some of these rules are very similar to rules we had before. The emergency expense rule really mimics the COVID-19 withdrawals that we allowed back in 2020, in that it's you can withdraw it in a year but repay over 3 years. That's to avoid that penalty tax. The federally declared disasters, there are already lots of provisions for tax benefits if you are in a federally declared disaster. The domestic abuse provision kind of mirrors the loan rules from a 401k. Just kind of smaller limits. Terminal illness. If you have a terminal illness, then yes, you can spend that money. I think that's some of these are just this no brainers, but it's a long, long, long list of provisions, and I don't know that we will ever finish talking about them.
But ultimately, it's just designed to encourage us to save for retirement, which is really important for us to do it for ourselves, since very few people have pensions any longer.
Really looking forward to Secure Act 3.0.
I have a two-part question. One, are you allowed to have more than one IRA? And
yes.
Two,
yes.
Can you, if you have the RMD, can you pull it out of one and stick
yes.
it in another one?
No, you can't stick it in another one.
Well, you can't stick the RMD in the other one, but if you are earning, you can both take a required distribution and make a contribution. But your contribution is still subject to the same contribution limits and deductibility limits. But that is possible, and we've definitely done that for folks.
And know that you can open up 10 different IRA accounts. The IRS looks at it as one lump sum. And so the calculation for what you have to take out is based on the total, but you can take it all out of one account if you want to.
So do I hear in the news this morning that interest rates are expected to go up again?
Yes. We've got a Fed meeting, an announcement this afternoon. No, tomorrow afternoon, Wednesday. Today is Tuesday. We will be hearing from the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, and all eyes and ears will be on this to figure out what is the direction going forward. But we are expecting an additional bump in the interest rates.
This is Money Talks, and we're looking for your personal finance questions this morning. You can email the show by sending it to money@mpbonline.org. You can always listen back to previous episodes at moneytalks.mpbonline.org, or you can download the MPB Public Media app for your smartphone and listen to all the MPB, local MPB Think Radio programs on your schedule. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lotridge-Anderson, president of New Perspectives and Ryder Tav, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. Between your calls this morning, we're talking about investing, and thank people who listen to Marketplace, public radio's financial show, each weekday evening at 6 on MPB Think Radio, often hear the numbers. And so, Nancy, we hear a lot about that. What does it mean to the personal, you know, at the personal level when we hear closing and that sort of thing, numbers from the stock market?
Well, we love to track those numbers all the time. We watch them. But those are reports of particular indexes. And so one of them
is... What's an index, Nancy?
Yeah, it's just a measure of a group of stocks.
How many stocks, Nancy? Okay.
So the Dow Jones Industrial Average is only 30 stocks, 30 big U.S. companies. And it was created by Charles Dow in the early 1900s when he said, you know, we need to have a way of monitoring how this market is moving. And so they came up with a very simple index, which is one share of 30 different companies, prominent companies at that time. So that's what we call a price-weighted index because – you know, a share of Amazon costs more than a share of Kroger, and a share of Tesla costs more than a share of Ford, but that doesn't have real meaning. And so this is not a very good index, even though we still have it around and it's the top of the news every time. What did the Dow Jones do? And it's only 30 companies, and it's heavy in oil. Those companies have changed through the years. I think the one with the biggest effect on markets is IBM now. You might check that, Ryder.
I'm looking that up.
Yeah.
But it is interesting. I mean, we say, oh, this isn't a great index, but it was the first one. It was the first idea anybody had. And it really gets to the point of these are just pieces of information that it just helps us understand. It's not the answer to everything, but it helps us understand kind of what was going on today. So that's the question that it got at.
Well, we also hear the S&P 500 is a better one to track and the one that most investors do pay attention to because it is 500 plus. It always is a few more than the 500 big U.S. companies. So it's a broader group and it is market weighted, not price weighted. So it's weighted based on the size of the company. And that is a truer picture of what the overall market is doing. We also have one, the NASDAQ, which is all the companies that are listed on NASDAQ. So that's going to be heavier in technology. And you're going to see a lot of influence from companies like Apple in that index. It just is a gauge of what's going on, of investor sentiment, how the market is moving, how volatile it is. It doesn't necessarily mean that your particular portfolio will be affected.
Do we know who Mr. Jones was?
Oh, yeah. He was Mr. Dow's partner, I think, wasn't he? I forget. We'll have to look that up. But I think the two of them were in business together on Wall Street, and that's how it's got its name.
I think that we have a caller on the line. And is it ready to go? If it is, we're going to be talking to Richard in Meridian. Good morning, Richard. You're on the air with us. Go ahead.
Good morning. I was just wondering what your thoughts are on index universal life insurance policies versus something like an IRA or even a Roth IRA.
We are not – well, it depends on what you're trying to use it for. If you have a need for a universal life policy, then get a universal life policy. But if you're trying to save and invest for future spending, then I would recommend investments, and you can do that through an IRA is one account. You can do that through a Roth IRA or just a taxable brokerage account. I think a lot of times an index universal life policy is kind of sold as a way to have both the investment side plus some death benefit plus some way to take money out in the form of a loan versus taking money out as a withdrawal. And there's certainly some difference there. But overall, when you look at them as a product, we often find that one, it doesn't actually meet the needs somebody says they actually have. They can do these two things separately. You can get cheap term insurance. You can get low-cost investments. You don't have to have the complication of that all-in-one bundle. You don't have to have that in a high-fee product because insurance policies, insurance companies, they are providing guarantees. And to provide a guarantee, that costs money. And that can cost a considerable amount of money depending on you and you know, what your, you know, how old you are, things like that. And so you have to pay that cost. You have to pay for that insurance. So they're often, again, pitched as a way you can get the best of all the worlds. But at the end of the day, they probably don't address those needs the way they are pitched.
I will reiterate what Ryder said. We really prefer for folks to keep their insurance as strictly insurance and their investments as strictly investments and not combine the two, even though a lot of insurance agents encourage you to do so and convince you can do that, but you end up with a pot of money that's difficult to access. So get the insurance, and the insurance should be to cover what if. Any kind of risk that you cannot cover yourself, use that for insurance, and then keep your savings separate.
All right, Richard, thank you for your phone call this morning. Richard broke the ice, so if you have a personal finance question, you can email the show by sending it to money@mpbonline.org. And between your phone calls, we're talking about investing this morning. Nancy, let's talk about teaching our kids about the stock market. What are some suggestions about getting our kids aware of and interested in the stock market?
Well, I'm going to get Ryder to jump in, too, on this one, because his family did it right, which is usually you need to start about in grade school when they can learn about this and they can understand a little bit more that a stock represents ownership in a company. So what's your story, Ryder?
Well, I was going to say one thing that I enjoyed as a child is a lot harder now because in the business section of the paper, there used to be all of the tickers. And it was every day just this sheets and sheets and sheets of numbers. And I liked numbers when I was a kid. I had no idea what was going on those sheets, but I did look at them. That's what got me started and got me really interested. But really, my story is that it's the Coca-Cola story. My sister owns some shares of Coca-Cola, and I only knew Coca-Cola as that soft drink that on a hot summer day when we drove up to our grandparents' house, then they would open one Coca-Cola and pour it in four little juice glasses for all us little kids. And
one little sip.
We got one little sip. It was the tiny little glass bottles too, you know, so it was just a taste because we didn't have it at home in our own refrigerator, so that was a real treat. But one day my dad explained to me that my sister owned shares of Coca-Cola, and you know, whatever, Dad, that's cool. I'm 7 years old. I'm going to go run and play. But then I had an epiphany. I realized she owned the company. And I thought that was just a million times cooler than owning the actual product. She owned the marketing of the product. She owned the creation of the product. She owned all of that that goes into getting a Coca-Cola to your fridge. I thought that was the coolest thing there. So that got me interested in owning and think about owning stocks as owning companies. And so that's really one of the ways to get children involved is what are products that they use?
That they know.
A lot of people just automatically go to say, oh, Disney. My kids love Disney movies. And that's great. We did just read, though, that over 50% of Disney subscribers, Disney Plus subscribers, do not have children. So maybe Disney is turning to an older folks thing. I don't know. People just trying to relive the memories there. But that's a classic way to get children involved. Brands they see, you see brands every day in the supermarket. You go to a supermarket, which may be publicly traded. There are stores they like. There are toys they like. There are movies they like. Get them interested in
that.
And
we've helped a lot of grandparents give a share of stock to a grandchild for a birthday or Christmas. That's a great way to get them started and get them interested. And most of them like to have one that they can set up in a DRIP, which is a dividend reinvestment plan. So a company like Coca-Cola that is paying dividends, and every time that dividend is paid, they get more shares of the stock. So that one share can start to build up, and they can watch that and get interested in what's happening there.
And I think one thing is also you got to cover a few basics before you hit stocks. I mean, they should understand kind of, again, say you're investing in a product in a store they see. They need to understand that we pay money for this product. They need to understand why is money useful. They need to understand that first. And then, well, where does this money go? Well, this money goes to pay the store owner for putting that product on their shelves and paying the people who brought it here and paying for their gas and paying for all the components that went into it. And understanding there is a company behind this. There's an entire business behind this. There's an entire business which is goal. The goal is to make money, and they can participate in that. So it's more than just participating in the item or the product. It's another level of it.
This is Money Talks on MPB Think Radio. We're looking for your personal finance questions this morning. Give us a call if you have one. 1-877-MPB-RING. It's 1-877-672-7464. You can always send an email as well to money@mpbonline.org. And before our first break, we will go to John, who's called in from Indianola. Good morning, John. You're on the air with us, so go ahead.
Well, hello. Thanks for having me. Love the show.
Thank you.
I just inherited $100,000. I don't necessarily need to use it, but I inherited $100,000, and I am retiring in October, and not sure any ideas on what to do with this $100,000.
Is that $100,000 coming to you from a retirement account or just straight taxes have already been paid on it?
It's in my bank.
Okay. It sounds like it's already come to him.
Right. So probably not an inherited account. So you have $100,000. You probably need to sit down with an advisor and look at, well, what are your needs going to be in retirement? Where will your income come from? Do you have a pension? Will Social Security kick in? And is there a gap between that income and what your expenses are? And is there a way for this $100,000 to fill that gap in some way? Or, as you said, if it's like, hey, I'm not going to need it, it's long term, then it probably needs to be invested in some combination of stocks and bonds, maybe a little heavier on the stocks because you don't need it. It's going to be your what-if money way down the road. But to think about, what do you want to happen with this money? Do you want to be able to play a little bit more? Do you want to use it to supplement your income? Or is it just going to be socked away somewhere where if there's some dire situation, you can access it, or maybe it's something you're going to pass on to family? But a talk with an advisor will help you with those.
I think that's a really interesting question. And of course, we don't know the rest of your situation, but there's a lot of so many things you can do with this. And you, so you mentioned that you were already close to retirement. So it sounds like you've probably got everything else figured out. You were already going to be okay. Your plan was going to work without this money. And that's great. So you can start thinking, were there, like Nancy said, plug in any gaps in your plan. That's important. But also, are there other goals you want to hit? You know, do you want to be more generous with children or charities? You can do that with this money. Do you want it to travel more? Maybe you can use this to supplement a little bit. Of course, cover, you know, plug in any gaps, especially things like emergency savings, this, now that you're going to be retired. But also, there you can use a lot of strategies to lower your overall taxes in retirement by using some of that money instead of withdrawals from an IRA. You can especially on the gifting side, if you're charitable, you can give to charities out of your IRA to reduce that taxable balance while you spend from the $100,000 that you inherited and have in your bank account. So there's just lots of ideas. But someone who can have a more comprehensive look at your financial situation, much more than we can diagnose over the show, would be very helpful.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate your time, and sounds like great advice. So
thanks for calling.
You.
Thank you, John, for your call. You are listening to Money Talks on MPB Think Radio. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lotter-Janderson, President of New Perspectives and Ryder Taft, Portfolio Manager at New Perspectives. They're both chartered financial analysts, and Ryder holds the Certificate in Investment Performance Measurement from the CFA Institute. You can send an email to money@mpbonline.org. Between your phone calls this morning, we're talking about some of the basics of investing. So, Nancy, some people suggest $5,000 to $10,000 to get started in investing, but there must be some lower cost ways that people can get involved.
There are tons of ways. You don't need that much. And in fact, most people are invested in the stock market through their company retirement plan. And so through that plan, just a few dollars with every paycheck can go in and purchase shares of stock if you want to, or bonds, or whatever you're doing within that company retirement plan. You can do this on your own. If you use a mutual fund, you can look up what the minimums are for that mutual fund. And typically they have different minimums depending on whether it's for an IRA account or just a regular, what we call a taxable account. They will be listed there. There are a lot of brokerage companies out there right now that allow you to buy shares of stock without a transaction fee. So you can buy one share. So if you have the money for that one share, again, Ford versus Tesla or Amazon, then you can buy a single share and start to build a portfolio. So it doesn't take much to get started.
Yeah, and a couple of things I'll point out. It's less what is the dollar amount you have available to you today. Because especially with technology, there are even brokers out there. I'm not sure quite what the minimum is, but even just a few dollars can get invested. But the question is, do you need to be investing if you only have $25? I would say getting started investing when you have a couple of your other bases covered. Make sure you have your savings account built up. There's no point in putting money at risk in the stock market if you can't afford groceries tomorrow. You need to have that money saved up, at least a couple months' expenses, at least be comfortable so that you know you're not going to have to dip back into that in any – there's no – not a big likelihood that's going to have to happen. And then Nancy mentioned retirement savings at work. Make sure you're participating in that, and make sure you're participating at a level that makes sense. Maybe for you, maxing it out doesn't make sense because of your salary, and maybe you're not
getting – what is the max?
The maximum in a 401k this year is $22,500.
Yeah.
So if you're only putting in 3% and you're not making what would that mean?
I can't do the math that fast.
$600,000? I don't know. Then you're not putting in the max. But for not everybody receives a ton of tax benefits from that. Not everybody needs all of their savings to be in a 401k. Sometimes a personal IRA or a taxable account can be a part of your financial plan. Particularly, say you're saving up for maybe a medium term goal. You wanna send your kids to college in 15 years. You wanna buy a new house or a new property in 10 years or so. That may make sense to have money outside your 401k for that. And so make sure you have other parts of your financial plan covered. It's not the dollar amount you have available today. And then the other thing I would say is, instead of just saying, okay, I finally saved up $5,000, where are the stocks? Just start with, once you have those other goals covered, just start with a regular savings amount. Maybe you open up an account and you're depositing $100 a month. Well, and then after a few months or a year, you can raise that to $200, $300, $400. And it's that consistent discipline of saving, because saving is an action. You have to keep saving and keep investing, because otherwise you're just throwing in all your hard-earned money and then you're just sitting there watching it gyrate with the market instead of consistently putting money in and consistently growing that account.
One thing about the employer match, and I think we've mentioned this on the program before, is sometimes the match that you can give to your employer is not necessarily the maximum amount that you can
contribute.
It
is never the maximum amount that you can contribute. Mm-hmm. And all the time I have people who come into our office and I'll say, well, what are you contributing to your 401k? And they'll say, the maximum. And it turns out what they mean is the most that will be matched by their employer.
The matchedumum.
Yes, the matchedumum. That is the least you can do. Because, you know, that if you don't at least contribute to what they're matching, that's 100% return. return on your money.
You got to take that free money
first.
Yeah,
because that's like walking past a $10 bill that's on the floor and not picking it up. So that's the minimum you should be doing is the employer match. And then the maximum is going to be determined by law. It is adjusted every year. So we're now in the $22,000 range. And there is an additional catch-up contribution maximum that is allowed for people who are over 50 years of age. And so that should be your goal through the life of your employment is to reach for that maximum amount. But most people can't do that because they got to pay their bills.
So, Ryder, nothing's guaranteed when you invest. Talk a little bit, if you would, about managing risk.
Sure. I think the first thing when you are investing is to understand what the risks are. I think a lot of people who are on the very nervous about the market side are concerned that all their money will disappear. Or that they just won't have access to their money. If you're just investing in a regular brokerage account, that money is yours. That money is generally fairly well insured against fraud, so you don't have to worry too. I mean, don't put your money with a disreputable broker or a broker that doesn't have adequate capital requirements. We've seen some of that in the past. But in general, that is not a big worry that you have. What the big worry is maybe there's a sustained decline in the market.
So Like last year.
All last year. Just every day was a down day. That's not every day was a down day, but it just felt like that. We just didn't have a whole lot of relief all last year and ended up down as much as 25% for the S&P 500. Something like 2008 was, I believe, a 50 or 60% decline in the market. And it took a long time to recover. And that's the sort of thing it's a drastic decline, a large decline. The risk, but you need to understand that doesn't happen every year. We don't know what's going to happen this year. And that's another reason why I said earlier, it's not about just throwing a lump sum in there and crossing your fingers that it only goes up. It's about consistently building that account. Because if you put in $100 one month and it goes down 50% the next month, I mean, that's terrible. I would hate to see that. But if you put in another $100 and you put in another $100 and that market starts coming back up, then you can really see that growth then over time. So understanding that you're investing for the long run is going to be really important.
And that is called dollar cost averaging.
So dollar cost averaging, like we just said, that's over time. You're putting in money over time. And so you're not just getting the price on the day you started, but you're getting over time, maybe there's some declines. You get a lower price. Maybe it only goes up and you only invest at higher prices. That also means your account's going up. So kind of a win-win from a kind of an emotional stress management standpoint. Diversify your account. Don't just put it in one stock. Don't just put in one section of the stock market. We encourage people to invest broadly across pretty much all investable stocks. That's U.S. stocks and foreign stocks. That's big stocks and small stocks. That includes bonds if that's appropriate for you, if you're depending on your time horizon. And again, remembering that investing in stocks is for the long term. It's not that, oh my goodness, I put money in January 2022, and by the end of the year, it was 20, 25% less. I mean, again, I would hate to see that, but if you needed money at the end of 2022, then I would not have encouraged you to put it all in the market in the beginning of 2022. If you said I need it in 2032, I would expect you to have that money to be growing over that time period.
And let me just say something about diversification, because people bring their 401k statements to us all the time, and they'll very proudly say, look, I am diversified. Mm-hmm. And what we know from research is that most people tend to do a simple diversification, which is basically eeny, meeny, miny, mo, I'm going to divide it up in four pots, 25% to each of these four different funds. And we often will look at that and said, all four of those funds are doing the same thing. You are not truly diversified. And so I try to tell people, if you're not savvy enough to create your own diversity and pick your own funds within that company retirement plan, or you get some help, then choose just one fund, which is your target retirement fund. It's called a life cycle fund that is diversified within that mutual fund based on your age. And so as you're younger, it's heavier in stocks. And as you age, it leans more into bonds.
So in doing some research on this, when we talked about investing for the long term, I found a Warren Buffett quote that I liked. He once said, "Our favorite holding period is forever."
That's right. Well, he buys insurance companies and companies that sell sugar. So,
well, my caution there is just one word, Sears.
This is Money Talks on MPB Think Radio. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lotridge-Anderson, president of New Perspectives, and Ryder Taft, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. Well, it's getting close to the top of the hour, which means the show is almost over, but you still have time to work in your personal finance question. As we await your question, we are talking about investing this morning. Nancy, we've used the term broker. What exactly is a broker? And I'm wondering, are they as important as they used to be?
Well, probably not. Some people still use a broker. And when we say the word broker, we use it two different ways. So when we say, I'm going to call my broker, then what you're really talking about is your registered representative, somebody who works for a brokerage house, and they're going to place trades for you. They're going to help you with all kinds of other issues on your financial situation. And then we talk about brokers. Those are going to be like the brokerage houses, like the old Merrill Lynch or, you know, Schwab, TD Ameritrade, E-Trade. These are all brokerage houses. And if you want to buy and sell all of these investments we're talking about, stocks, bonds, ETFs, you're going to have to go through a brokerage house. They're the ones that can then make sure those trades occur. And so then you have full-service brokers, which those are going to be the folks who are getting a commission off of what they're doing for you, which is fine as long as you understand that they are getting a commission. And the idea is they offer you other services for that commission, not only placing the trades, but helping you with all kinds of other issues. And then you have discount brokers, and a discount broker is a Schwab or a TD Ameritrade, where you're basically on your own to do everything. So they will place the trades for you, but you have to decide, what am I going to buy? When am I going to buy it? What are all my other financial issues? In our business as registered investment advisors, we kind of put the two together. So we use discount brokers, and then we also layer on with providing financial advice and financial planning on top of that.
And so I think it's less that, oh, are brokers as important? They are still incredibly important. It's just most people's interaction with them is not the old Wolf of Wall Street. They're just waiting for a call for someone to sell them a stock. A broker is still the person or institution standing in between you, the customer, and the stock exchange, or even in between us as kind of institutional managers and the stock exchange, because that is how you access it. A normal person cannot just go plug their computer into the stock exchange and say, hey guys, anyone want to buy this stock or sell this stock to me? So they still play an incredibly important role. We just might interact with them less.
And let me just say that the U.S. markets, we have a variety of exchanges, but the U.S. markets are heavily regulated. And as investors, we like that they're heavily regulated and they're transparent. We have some of the best markets in the world. That's why a lot of foreign investors want to invest in our markets. We attract a lot of capital globally because people know it's going to be fair and it's going to be regulated, and they're not going to be nefarious things going on, we hope. You know, you always have a little bit of stuff going on out there, but the U.S. markets are secure, monitored, regulated, and that's the way you want it as an investor.
So earlier in the show, we talked about the Dow Jones Industrial Average. We get credited Mr. Dow. And I think, Ryder, you did some research and we found out who Mr. Jones is.
Mr. Jones.
Yes. His business partner was a man named Edward Jones, which interestingly is also a pretty large brokerage house.
A full service brokerage.
I don't know that he's actually related to that. It may have just been named after him. I mean, that's unclear to me. I don't know the history of that brokerage. I'm not going to get into that.
All right, but we didn't want to give him short shrift. So Edward Jones, you've been mentioned here this morning.
Just in case.
Well, Mr. Dow gave him credit.
If you are a descendant of Charles Dow or Edward Jones, please give us a call and tell us about your great grandfather.
So we've mentioned mutual funds a couple of times this morning. So Ryder, if you could give us a reminder of what exactly a mutual fund is.
Sure. Yes. So that's one of the things when we're talking about these stocks, all these stocks or bonds, how do you pick one of those stocks? Well, you could spend your entire life researching and trying to learn how to pick a good stock and still never pick a good stock. But fortunately, you can hire someone to do it for you. So a mutual fund, any type of fund, is a pool of stocks. There will be a manager of that fund, and the fund will be a pool of money that all sorts of investors put in, and the manager decides what stocks we're going to buy, what bonds we're going to buy, when we're going to buy them, when we're going to sell them. So classically, that has been a mutual fund. There's a lot of different structures here, but the biggest are mutual funds and exchange-traded funds. A mutual fund, they've set up a company, you send them the money, and they'll go and do the investing. Oftentimes, that can be an active manager. The structure allows them to do quite a lot of things in the stock market. A newer, it's not as new. We did just celebrate the 30th birthday of the first exchange-traded fund. But an exchange-traded fund is it's not a fund where you have to mail off a check to the company. You can buy it just through a regular brokerage
just
account
like stock.
During the day, just like a stock. These are traded on an exchange during the day, hence the name exchange-traded fund. And they are not strictly limited to, but they are often preserved for index funds, which just track an index. So we mentioned the Dow Jones, that is an index, the S&P 500, that is an index, just because they don't need, an index fund doesn't need the capabilities that a mutual fund structure allows. So it is a little simpler just to have them as an index fund.
Nancy, is one of the advantages of a mutual fund the fact that your money is being pooled in together with everybody else that's investing in it?
Right. You get instant diversification, and you can get that with a small amount of money. And mutual funds are perfect vehicles for retirement accounts. So your employer plan, you're going to be handed, we call it a plan menu. And any kind of retirement plan tries to design a menu that looks like a diner menu, that there's something for everybody there, okay? So if you're just like, oh, I've got to keep it very, very safe, it's going to be in something like a money market versus I want to be heavy in stocks. And there's all kinds of fund offerings within there that you can choose from. They're really good for that. Ryder mentioned with exchange-traded funds, they trade like stocks, so that price changes all during the day. A mutual fund, the price is set at the end of the trading day. So you can place a trade for a mutual fund during the day, but it's not going to clear and close until overnight when they figure out, well, okay, what's the price per share based on what we own and all of this.
One of the great things about a mutual fund is you can't day trade it. So that is
yes.
That is one of the features there. And so that's one of the reasons one of your favorites, Jack Bogle, was a big fan of mutual funds, is because it forced people to have a longer term perspective. And because of the structure of it, you typically do have to hold them longer. You can't just buy it one day and sell it the other day, typically without penalties.
And Bogle was also the father of indexing. He's giving credit for that.
That is right.
Which leads us into exchange-traded funds, which started with the idea of being tracking an index, mm-hmm. which is a cheaper way to do it. And we know from research that if you can cut your expenses within those funds that you're purchasing, you're going to leave more money in your pocket and have a higher return.
All right. 30 seconds left. Going to put you both on the spot. One takeaway from today's discussion, Ryder.
Well, I think the getting started investing is very important. You got to have your other bases covered, but just get started as a regular deposit. Don't worry about, oh, I need X dollars saved up. Make sure you have your other financial bases covered and then just start that regular investment habit.
And if you want to build wealth, you have to combine it with two things. The first is the discipline, and Ryder talked about that earlier, just save, save, save. But you have to put that together with knowledge about the financial markets. So pick up a book, go to your library, learn what you can, and you'll start to build wealth.
All righty. That's going to wrap us up for today. Money Talks is a production of MPB Think Radio, funded in part by generous financial support from listeners. You can listen back to this or any episode at moneytalks.mpbonline.org. All local MPB Think Radio programs are also available as podcasts, and our podcast producer is Jermaine Flood. So for Dr. Nancy Lotcher-Janderson and Ryder Taff, I'm Kevin Farrell, inviting you to join us every Tuesday at 9 for Money Talks. It's heard only on MPB Think Radio.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.